This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. A federal judge this week unexpectedly ruled that the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline project cannot simply function as planned. According to U.S. District Judge James Boasberg in Washington, the Army Corps of Engineers did not complete a proper environmental impact review. The judge laid out his arguments in a 91-page ruling that considered, among other things, quote, environmental justice or the degree to which the pipeline's effects are likely to be controversial, a sign that the months of protest by indigenous-led water protectors at Standing Rock, North Dakota last year had a great impact. At the People's Summit last week in Chicago, Illinois, I met with one indigenous leader involved in the Standing Rock actions in North Dakota. Judith LeBlanc is the director of the Native Organizers Alliance. She served as the United Nations representative for the Indigenous World Association, a non-governmental organization. And I spoke with her before this new decision by the judge came out.
I'm at the People's Summit in Chicago with Judith LeBlanc. She is the director of the Native Organizing Alliance. Hi, Judith.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks so much for joining us today. This has been a very interesting conference. You just wrapped up a panel discussion on water, jobs, and justice. And the big, big organizing issue, the big front line of progressive organizing last year in 2016, outside of the election, was the Dakota Access Pipeline and the protests against them, the water protectors. It was a huge issue. One of the things that I think many people point to as being a very tangible undoing of or unraveling of our victories, even small victories, has been what Donald Trump decided on the Dakota Access Pipeline. What is the status right now? Is that pipeline was already close to being operational. Is it operational?
Well, the oil is flowing. The oil is flowing. But the truth is, we won. We won some big victories as a result of this organizing of people power and prayer. I mean, what we did at Standing Rock was to bring an unprecedented level of unity among over 400 tribes. Never in indigenous history has that happened, even during the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And secondly, we helped people, our people, reconnect with the path that our ancestors have laid for us. You know, 50% of us live in cities. I like to say I walk with a high heel on one foot and a moccasin on the other. And so many of our people came there and reconnected for the first time with the significance of being indigenous, came and found that our cultures, we were sharing our cultures intertribally. We saw what the similarities were, but also the differences. And in many ways, we began to reimagine what it would be like to govern in a traditional ways. And the Osheti Chacon elders, the Council of the Seven Fires, the Lakota, Nakota, Dakota tribes, actually led the camp by reinstituting traditional ways of governing. Because when you get 10,000 Indian folks together, we bring our social problems. We bring drug abuse and alcoholism and violence with us. And so the elders, along with the traditional leaders called the headsmen for each of the seven tribes, found ways to deal with those problems with what we like to call outside of Indian country, restorative justice practices, which have been really a part of our history, but have been stripped from us by colonialism.
Wow, I hadn't even thought about that aspect of the movement. So in a way, what you're saying is it signaled the beginning of a new movement of unified values just within Native communities. And so, if so, what did that sort of restorative justice look like? Can you give us some examples of things that might have transpired at Standing Rock, where instead of resorting to, you know, calling the police, etc., people dealt with them within communities?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the most important thing about Native culture, which is shared by many tribes, is the idea that consensus, building consensus, bringing people into a circle to decide how to handle problems. It's as old as dirt. We did that from the very beginnings. And it was a struggle to learn how to do that in the 21st century, when in fact we were in a very militarized situation, and we were living in a situation of uncertainty. The camp culture was such that it was what I characterize as hurry up and wait culture, because you'd go on for days and weeks where nothing was going on, and then suddenly everything was going on, and there were a lot of very violent actions that were provoked by the Dakota Access Pipeline Company. And the restorative justice, or the traditional way of handling problems, was seen in many different ways. Number one, how to handle problems of misogyny, how to help our men become accountable to women in leadership, how to help them understand how the violence that we were seeing on the front lines was really a reflection of a system that uses violence to divide people, and how therefore domestic violence is just reflecting a colonial way of behaving. There were other instances where the idea and the power of our unity was used to bring people together to address the problems of violence that was coming from inside our camp. But now, with the revelations that The Intercept published, we know, and many of us from, I'm American Indian Movement generation. I grew up politically and lived at Pine Ridge after the occupation was over. And many times we would say, this is just like what the FBI would do to
tell pro.
Yes, exactly.
So actually, tell our audience just a little bit about what The Intercept found and whether your experiences at Standing Rock in looking back confirm some of that.
Well, the Intercept actually interviewed a former employee of the private security company that was hired by Energy Transfer Partners. And we knew from the very beginning that the security company had orders to use force against peaceful protesters. Our camp was a prayer camp. It was centered on really prayers and listening. And listening to our community as to how to handle the situation, how to prevent the pipeline from being built. And so now it's been revealed that Energy Transfer Partners set their own vehicles on fire. They blamed us. They were even given permission to use deadly force against us. And so in that kind of situation where they're flying planes over us, they're shining lights all night long into the camp, and they're trying to provoke violence, many of our people understood that it takes more strength to remain in prayer and to be centered in our values than it is to be angry and to react violently.
That's what they wanted. They were trying to provoke violence. So even though the oil is flowing in Dakota Access Pipeline, what lessons can be applied from what happened at Standing Rock to the many other projects of the fossil fuel industry that impact Indian country today? Because we know that Dakota Access was just one of many projects.
Well, number one, if we're going to save Mother Earth, then we must not forget that the struggle begins by keeping the oil, fossil fuels, in the ground. And that's where the point of struggle must begin. Not simply to resist a pipeline that is being built to transport the oil. Secondly, that we've learned that it is decisive for environmental justice groups, climate justice groups, to have strong relationships with indigenous leadership, with tribes and the social movements that develop around protecting water and Mother Earth. Why? Because we have a spiritual, a moral, and we have a legal right to protect Mother Earth. And with their support, we can begin to exercise that tribal sovereignty, which can protect a significant land base in the United States. Before the climate justice movement was much more of a white middle class science-based movement. Science is important, but if facts could win the day, no one would drive drunk, would they? What we need is a hearts and minds approach to saving Mother Earth. That's what Native leadership brings. It brings a connection to Mother Earth and to water and to the path that our ancestors have laid to protect this land, to be a caretaker of the land. So that's the second lesson. The third is that we have to uncover and reveal for all to see the corporate role in desecrating Mother Earth. The power of Standing Rock led many, many groups that are not indigenous groups to lead campaigns that successfully divested over $5 billion from banks that are invested in the Dakota Access Pipeline. It's a tremendous victory. We have to get to the corporate roots corporate profiteering that drives reliance on fossil fuel.
So we certainly are seeing more visible leadership in the environmental justice movement of Native communities, I think more so than ever before, which is very heartening. And I'm wondering if at a gathering like this, the People's Summit, where a lot of people are looking not just to sort of organize at the grassroots level, but also actually win power, I'm wondering what ways are Native groups getting involved, for example, in the electoral process? Because under Donald Trump, things have gone from bad to worse. We've gone from Obama to Trump. And rather than improving on the Obama legacy, of course, Trump is simply undoing the Obama legacy. So are there Native organizations, individuals, who cut their teeth at Standing Rock, who are looking to occupy positions of political power now?
Absolutely. And you know, the last election, it was the largest number of Native candidates ran for local office in the history of the U.S.
That's amazing.
And we elected a whole crop of folks who were going to be in state legislatures deciding on policies not just for Indigenous people, but for the communities as a whole. In Minnesota, for example, we elected three Indian women, the first gay Indian women to be in the state legislature. And the truth is that we're the only people in this country that have to deal with so many various different kinds of government policies and holding governments accountable. First, we have our own elected tribal leadership. And that is a whole area of activism where we now have many water protectors who will be running for tribal council positions in order to play a leading role in protecting water and land and air on their own reservations. Every reservation has a water problem. The second is that we need to and do have elected officials in South Dakota, for example, who are playing like a frontline role in trying to protect the right to protest. In South Dakota, just as in North Dakota, there was a law that was brought forward to outlaw water protection as a criminal terrorist act, but it was defeated. We have five elected state reps and one state senator who represent indigenous populations, but also white people as well. So the most important lesson that we can draw is that we need to also run people for the federal level as well, because the federal government, state governments, our own governments sometimes will have conflicting policies when it comes to regulating corporations and infrastructure projects or fighting for certain water quality. So our challenge is to seek election to every layer of government because they affect Indian life, Indian country. I'm very hopeful. I think many of the people became so much more empowered coming out of Standing Rock, understanding the power of prayer, but also being organized and to leverage the grassroots militancy that was seen there in local struggles all across the country, and therefore the need to run for office to represent our basic values and core interests.
So finally, Judith, what do you, what about solidarity between different groups? What sort of lessons came out of the connections made between Native organizers and allies, because Standing Rock was one of those few places where it was made very clear that Native leadership was important, that people who wanted to go to Standing Rock had to get permission to go there and had to be subservient to that leadership. And this is something the left has struggled with, because we have, you know, we bring to the table all the same societal prejudices and difficulties with understanding our own privileges. So I'm wondering what constructive things came out of interactions between Native and non-Native activists that made you more optimistic about sort of inter-ethnic organizing.
Well, I think traditional Native wisdom is so simple, but yet strong. And that is, for example, you need to be a good relative. Rather not you're Native and you go to Lakota Territory, or you're white or black or Latino or Asian, you need to be a good relative. That means respecting the people whose land you are on. And I think that for the climate justice movement, they very much tried to play that role, to support but not control. That is a new dynamic. It's taken many years of struggle by indigenous environmental justice groups to help our brothers and sisters in the climate justice movement to understand that we have a moral, spiritual, and a legal right that this movement needs to help us exercise to protect land, air, and water. But the second thing is, I think that the interrupting and disrupting the racist colonial narrative of who we are as a people has actually opened up a space where we can be here at the People Summit. We've spoken in two plenaries, we've spoken at a number, included in a number of panels, and I think it's way past time that indigenous people are at all of the tables. I mean, we have generational unemployment. We not only have water issues, generational unemployment, the health care cuts, the attacks on Obamacare will have a terrifying effect in Indian country. So for us all to win, we need to have a greater level of unity, Native and non-Native, and respecting our various cultures and a different way of looking at things that we have as a people and a culture.
Judith LeBanc, thank you so much for joining us. Would you like to give out a website for Native Organizing Alliance?
Yes, it's nativeorganizing.org, and we have a much more active Facebook page, Native Organizers Alliance, and we run an annual Native organizing training open to Native community organizers, tribal officials every year, so watch Facebook for the announcement if you're Native.
Thank you so much again, Judith.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Judith LeBlanc, director of the Native Organizers Alliance. She serves as the United Nations representative for the Indigenous World Association, a non-governmental organization. I spoke with her at the People Summit in Chicago, Illinois, and after we spoke, a judge decided on Wednesday that the Army Corps of Engineers needs to redo a complete environmental review, which many activists and water protectors consider a major victory. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.